Welcome to Gemara Markings. Today's shiur is Erechin Daf Zayin. Don't forget to click on the Daf option in order to view a marked Daf Gemara for today's shiur. If you are not fully familiar with our Gemara marking system and wish to benefit from its great rewards, it is essential that you study all of the introductory material accessed by clicking on the Learn the System option provided on the sidebar of our home page. If you are already partially familiar, you will benefit by clicking on the brief 4-minute introduction that is available here. Being that our system is a visual approach to the Daf Gemara, it is recommended that you print out the Daf before the Shiur. And even better, order your personal volume of this Maseches. Our address is gmarkings@gmail.com. As we turn to the Gemara, we will begin today's Shiur at the lower part, two lines from the bottom of Daf Vov Amud Beis. You will notice at that point in the Gemara, a squiggle underlined expression, the Ikar Demasni law, and in the space to the immediate right-hand side of the Gemara text, a Roman numeral number 2. We are, in effect, learning a second version of the Machloikes between Rabba and Rav Yosef in their explanation of a Machloikes Tanoim. Just to recap, in our previous shiur, we had a Machlokes Tanoim regarding a person being taken out for court execution. On his way out, he damaged someone. The Mishnah told us that according to Rabbi Yossi, he is chayav in Tashlumen. That means he's obligated to compensate for damages. According to the Tanakama, though, he would be exempt. We try to analyze what's the point of controversy based on. So Rav Yosef gave us his opinion, and that a controversy was based on milva al pe goivim na yorshim. Does something that constitutes a financial obligation that's not recorded in a document enable the heirs to be collected from? In this case, the victim of the perpetrator. Being that the perpetrator has just been executed, can he turn to the heirs to receive collection? According to Rabba, the basis of the Machlokas was something called Milva HaKzuva Batura, a Torah-based debt, or Torah-based financial obligation. The fact that the Torah records a financial obligation, is that tantamount to having it written in a document? And, of course, that, too, will have bearing on whether heirs can be seized upon for collection. The assumption being that, according to Rabba, that is, a milva al peh, a straightforward oral agreement, cannot be compensated for, or one cannot seize collection from the heirs. However, if something is considered as if it's written in a document, then heirs can be collected from. Well, anyway, that's Rabba's presentation of the Machlokes Tanoim. This same Rabba Rav Yosef Machlokes that we have highlighted with a double underline with dots in it, as you can see, will be featured now and attached to a different Tanaic source that we are about to learn. So we pick up the Gemara two lines from the bottom, the Ikar Demasni lo aho. In our markings, squiggle underlines are often used to denote a transition in version of whatever is being presented. You'll find expressions like Ikar D'Amri and Iboy Esema treated the same way. In this case, Ikar D'Masni Lo, another version concerning which Rabba and Rav Yosef taught their points of view, aha, on the following Tanaic source, which you can see is in a frame. Hayotse Lehoreg, someone who is on his way out to be executed. Hu shechoval b'acherim chayov. If he, choval, is to injure, to damage, assault and battery, if he assaulted someone and hurt them, he is chayov. In other words, there is an obligation to pay for the damages. Acherim shechov lubo p'turim. However, others that damaged him on his way to execution are exempt. They don't have to pay. In other words, he has no value. He's on his way to be executed. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Oimer. Af hu im chova b'achirim potter. Reb Shimon ben Elazar, here you have the second opinion in this source being the lenient opinion, which is in contrast with our Mishnah, where we saw the second opinion, in that case it was Reb Yossi, who was the stricter of the two. So he offers exemption for the case of others, if he, the perpetrator, the condemned man, damages others. So he too will be exempt. Shelo nitan l'chazoras amidas beisdin. The reason for his exemption is that he can't be taken back to be prosecuted for the damage that he inflicted, because he is on his way to be executed. And any delay in executing the execution would be an affront, would be a violation of something called Inui Hadin, delaying the carrying out of justice. So, because of this problem called Inui Hadin, delaying his execution, we do not prosecute him on the damages that he may have caused others on his way out to be killed. The Gemara now, at the top of Zayin Omid Aleph, reacts with wonderment, with a question on, well, then, what's the opinion of the Tanakhama? Because according to this, the Tanakhama says, Hu shechava becherem chayov, if he damaged others, then there is guilt. There is a requirement to compensate. That would imply that we do delay his execution in order to process or prosecute him on the issue of the assault. Well, how could that be? Michlal the Tanakhama savar nitan l'chazoras amidas beisdin. Could it be that the Tanakhama holds you can delay the justice? It's not possible. So we have to understand then what's the point of machlokis between the Tanakhama and, in this case, the second opinion was Rav Shimon ben Elazar. Omar Rav Yosef. B'milva al peh goive min hayorshim komifligi. A non-written financial obligation, can it be collected from heirs? Tanakhama sovar milva al peh goive min hayorshim. The Tanakhama that said that the yotzei lehoreg, that afflicts someone, that is assaults someone, is chayav to pay, because he is of the opinion that an oral debt can be seized upon from his heirs, from his beneficiaries. Rav Shimon ben Elazar sovar eino goive min hayorshim. Rav Shimon ben Elazar that suggested that there is exemption, he is of the opinion that you cannot collect a non-written debt from heirs. Rabba Omar, dekule alma milve al pe eino goive min hayorshim. According to Rabba, all the Tanoim would agree that an oral financial debt would not be able to be collected from heirs. The hocha, in this case, where we're dealing with assault, b'milve haksuva b'turuk iksuva b'shtar komifligi. Since the requirement to compensate for assault is accounted for in the Torah, this becomes a milve, a financial debt that's recorded in the Torah. Does that make it as if it's recorded in a document? And as we mentioned earlier, something that's recorded in a document certainly can be collected from heirs. Here, the question is it as if it's recorded in a document by the fact that the Torah makes a record of it? Tanakhama sovar, kiksuva b'shtar dami. The Tanakhama that says that the offender incurs an obligation to compensate, and the collection will be made from the heirs, that's because it is considered, this payment for assault is considered kiksuva b'shtar, as if it's recorded in a document. Rabbi Shimon Elazar, sofar lav kiksuva b'shtar damya. It's not considered as if it's recorded in a shtar, and therefore no collection can be made. Of course, from the heirs. Meisvei. The Gemara now raises a kasha, raises an objection. We'll see a Tanaic source, and we'll pay attention to the dashed underlined phrases in this source. Hachoifer bor b'shus harabim v'nofal olav shor v'horagoi. Someone who was digging a pit in a public area, which is something that's quite unlawful, and a shor, an ox walking by, falls on the pit digger and kills the digger. Potter, the owner of the animal, will be exempt from having to compensate. V'lo oid elo she'im meis hashor. If not only that, but if the shor dies in his fall, yorshe bal habor chayovin l'shalem demei shor l'balov. The heirs of the pit digger will be obligated to compensate the owner of the ox for his loss. Now, we have a little note to look in the Rabbeinu Gershom. You'll notice there's a star, and you'll find toward the end of the narrow lines, of the last narrow line of the Rabbeinu Gershom commentary, he writes, V'kashio l'manda omar milve haksuva boi raiso Lav kiksuva b'shtar damya. According to Rabba, the Tanakama that said there would be exemption for the case of the assault is because there was a, that milve, we should say, according to Rab Shimon ben Elazar, the reason for exemption would be that something that's recorded in the Torah is not as if it's recorded in a document. We might as well point out that according to Rabba in the first Lashon of his presentation, he said that the opinion of the Tanakama was that a milveh haksuva b'Torah lav kiksuva b'shtar damya. According to that first Lashon of Rava, you're taking a Stam opinion, an unnamed opinion, which is generally speaking quite authoritative, and saying that it's not as if it's recorded in a shtar, and here you have an unnamed source which is considered authoritative, saying that that which is recorded in the Torah is considered as if it's written in a document. So this source represents a problem for Rabba's presentation of the issue of Milva Haksuva B'Torah, presenting the Tanakama's opinion as holding in the first Lashon, Lav Kiksuva B'Shtar, and here we have it presented as if it is Kiksuva B'Shtar. And Rashi says on the second narrow line, he says, the im kein kashya stamo astamo. This would be a problem of two unnamed sources, which are generally speaking to considered authoritative, to be in contradiction with one another. So the Gemara goes on. Omar of Ilo Omar Rav, kisha omad bedin. The case of the digger is talking about a case where the digger stood up in justice and received a verdict of guilt. A court-issued verdict is certainly considered by everybody as if it's been recorded in a shtar. The Gemara asks, how can you say that the case of the digging of the pit was where the digger stood in justice? V'horgoi kotoni. It said in that story that the ox fell on him and killed him. Omar Rav Ado bar Ahavo, kishaso trefa. when it says in the source that he killed the digger, it doesn't mean he literally killed him, but he injured him in a mortal way, causing him to become a trefa, which is a person that is going to die. And hence the term hargo was used. But nevertheless, he was able to stand up in a court of justice, thereby receiving a verdict, making it as if it's, according to everyone, kiksuva bishtar, and hence payment must be made. The Gemara asks, V'ho Omar Rav Nachman, Toni Chago. Chago is the name of someone who stated a Tanaic source, and he said, Meis v'kovro, in the case of the court digging of the pit, he taught that case where the digger died and was buried, not simply made into a trefa, a sick individual that is going to die, but he was killed almost instantly and buried. The final explanation of that source is the Yasvi Dayoni Apuma Debira, that when the ox fell on the court digger and in fact killed him, not just making him into a trefa, there were judges sitting at the edge of that pit and they issued a verdict immediately. Therefore, the source where we had dashed underline Yorshe Balabor Chayovin L'Shalem is talking about an obligation that everyone would agree with because it's after a court decision was rendered. Tanu Rabbanan. Before continuing in the Gemara, we have a topic heading in the outside margin. It says, HaKrovas Korban Chatos Avur Mi Sheyotzi Lahoreg. The offering of a sin offering for someone that's on his way out to be executed by the court. Al Chet She'ova Koidem Lochein. Al Chet She'chote B'sho She'yotze Lehoreg. Two issues concerning when the sin was violated that warrants the bringing of the sin offering. The first incident would be a sin that was committed beforehand. The other is a sin that was committed as he was being taken out to be killed. The Gemara. Tanu Rabbanan. Hayotze lehoreg. Mazin olov midam chatoso umidam ashamo. Mazin is a reference to the sprinkling of the blood of the sacrifice. We should say an additional word of introduction for this topic, and that is that a sin offering is never brought for an individual that died. That's called chatos shemesu baleha. Here we're talking about a person who's being taken out to be executed. So on his way out, we say that we sprinkle the blood of the korban for this individual. And we don't say that it's considered a sin offering brought for a dead person. Chota b'oisa shah ein nizkokin loy. Let us say that a person on his way out to be executed happened to eat some forbidden fats, which is called chelev, and he ate it inadvertently. Generally speaking, a person that commits an offense like that, the eating of chelev b'shogeg, he's chayev a korban chatos, he's obligated to bring a sin offering. In this case, we don't set aside a korban for him to be sacrificed. The Gemara asks, "My time? Well, why not?" Omer of Yosef Mnei She'ein Me'anin Ezdino. Since he's on his way to be executed, if we were to insist on setting aside a sacrifice on his behalf, we would have to delay the execution until the animal is sacrificed and the blood is sprinkled. And we don't want to delay this man's execution based on this rule of Ein Ma'anin Esdino. Omar Le Abaye, Ihochi, if that is your concern, Afilu Reisho Nami. In the Reisho, which in which we mentioned a sin that he had committed earlier. There too is delay. We will delay his execution until we sprinkle the blood. The Gemara answers, in the Reisha case there is no delay. The case in the Reisha featured an individual whose korban was already slaughtered. So as he, the victim, or the condemned man, is walking to be executed, in the Beis HaMikdash they can sprinkle the blood of the korban without causing any delay. Aval, ein zivcho zavuch b'yisashah mai. What if the person on his way out to be executed did not have his sacrifice already slaughtered at that time? Then loi, are you going to tell me then that we would not process the korban? Well, then aditoni, instead of coming to teach me chota b'yisashah ein is kokin lo, the case of his having committed a sin at that time, we don't deal with him. We don't deal with him sacrificially. Why do you come on to a new case of chota b'oisashah? Lifloig v'lisni b'dida. You could have made a distinction within the case of someone who had sinned earlier and made the following distinction. B'med v'murim, when do we sprinkle the blood for this person, for this Yotzei Lahareg? Shehoya Zevach Zavuch B'Yisashah, where his sacrifice had already been slaughtered and all they needed to do was to sprinkle the blood. Aval Ein Zevach Zavuch Loi, but if he did not have the sacrifice already slaughtered, so we wouldn't deal with him. We wouldn't bother sacrificing or slaughtering and getting the blood together and then sprinkling, because that would involve Inui Hadin, a delay in his execution. So, generally speaking, if you have a Tanaic source and you want to make a distinction, instead of going to a new case to make this distinction, you could have made the distinction of whether Niskokinlo or Ein Niskokinlo in the case of a sin committed earlier, and the whole point of difference being was the sacrifice already slaughtered at this time or not. So the Gemara says, you're right, everything is correct. Hochi Nami Komar. That's in fact the intent of this source. And we have a frame around the rereading of the source. When is it that we say that we sprinkle the blood for this person who's Yotzei Lahareg? We sprinkle the blood of his sin offering. Shehoya Zevach Zavo Boisashah, where his sin offering had already been slaughtered, and there's no issue of time delay anymore. All that needs to be done is the blood spread on the altar, and that can be done as he is being taken out to be executed. Aval ein zevach zavuch. If, however, this person did not have his sacrifice was not already slaughtered at this point, it's then viewed as if he sinned just now, the ein niskokin lo, and we don't deal with him, we don't process his sacrifice. Just like someone who sinned right now, that certainly would involve a delay in setting up the animal for slaughter and sprinkling, so too in a person who had sinned earlier, if his sacrifice has not already been slaughtered, so we do not deal with his sacrifice either, because of Inui Hadin. The Mishnah. A woman who is guilty of a capital offense, and she is being led out to her court execution. Ein mamtinen lo ad sheteled. If she was a pregnant woman, we don't wait for her execution until the child is born. Ha'isha she yoshva al hamashver. A woman, as Rashi says, before the verdict was issued, a verdict of guilt for a capital offense, if before the verdict was issued, she started labor, that's Yoshva Lamashber, she started going into bearing the child, into birthing, Mamtinin lo ad sheteled. The expression that you find in Rashi is the okar v'no mimkomo, the vlad, the child is starting it's left its place in the womb, apparently entering the birth canal. So if that point has been reached before the verdict was issued, so we wait before issuing the verdict until she bears the child. Ho'isha shenehergo nehenin besaira, a woman who was executed, we can benefit from her hair. This will be explained by the Gemara later on. Behemo shenergo, an animal that was sentenced to execution because it had killed a person. Asuro bahano, the animal, the entire animal is forbidden to benefit from. Before going on in the Gemara, our topic heading, the Nosei, Hamokor lahodikatoni di shishiyotsu lahoreg ein mamtinin lo ad shetele. The woman who is taken out, led out for execution, we don't wait till she gives birth. So the Gemara asks, Pshita gufa hi. It's obvious we don't wait. It's the embryo is just like part of her body. It's like her arm. And this woman has been sentenced to be executed. So we take her out. We don't wait until she gives birth. The Gemara says, Itzterich, I need to be taught this in the Mishnah. Sakudai techamina. I would have thought without this teaching, Hoyul uksiv, since the Torah says, in a case of a pregnant woman who was injured and her embryo was miscarried as a result, the Torah says, Kasher yoshis olov baal ho'isha. There is a payment, there's compensation made to the father of that unborn for the unborn's death, for its miscarriage. So when we look at a woman who's pregnant, we realize that there is a financial holding, so to speak, or a financial vested interest on the part of the husband of this woman. So the embryo, the unborn, is mamoina debalhu velo lifsede mine. So what? The woman herself is chayev to be executed. Nevertheless, she's carrying a child, and this child is considered the mamon, the possession, if you will, with having potential financial ramifications for the husband. Therefore, we shouldn't kill her right now. Komash malon, that's what the Mishnah says, that we don't wait, and the fact that the husband experiences this loss, that's the way it is. The Gemara says, "V'eima hochinami." Well, maybe we should wait because of the loss to the husband. Omar Rabbi Avo, Omar Rabbi Yochanan, Omar Kro, Umesu Gam Shnehem. This posuk that says Umesu Gam Shnehem is L'Rabois Esavlad. It says, "And they shall both die," indicating that the Torah expects the mother and the unborn to be killed. The Gemara asks, "Vaha v'hai mi boyale?" But this source of umesu gam shneim, this pasuk is used for something else. That something else is ad shiu shneim shovin divrei Rabbi Yoshia. This is a quote from the Gemara elsewhere that speaks about people involved in active immorality. A death penalty is issued for offenders in that area, but that, according to Rabbi Yoshua, is true only if both are of legal age. In other words, that neither one is a minor. The pasuk says umesu gam shneim, indicating some form of equivalency or equality between the two offenders. If one of them would be a minor, so the adult offender would not be executed. Anyway, we see that umesu gam shneim is used for that topic, and not as an instruction to kill the unborn together with the mother. The Gemara says, ki ko'amris, when I said that this pasuk is used to include the vlad, the unborn, mi gam, from the word gam in the pasuk. So the pasuk we read, umesu gam shneim, teaches us two things, but from two different vantage points. Umesu shneim teaches me the halacha of both offenders would have to be of legal age in order to carry out the death penalty. The word gam teaches me that the vlad of the unborn of a woman sentenced to death is to be killed along with her. Yoshva al hamashper v'chulei, the Mishnah said that if the woman goes into childbirth, then we wait until the child is born. My taima, why do we wait? After all, we said a moment before that the unborn is considered just another limb of the mother. So the Gemara explains, Kivan de Okar, since the child has left its place of fetal development and entered the birth process, entered the birth canal, Gufo Achrina Hu, it's now considered a separate entity. So that's enough to warrant the delay and wait till she gives birth and then issue the verdict. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Isha Hayotze Lahoreg, a woman who is being taken out for court execution. Makin Oisok Yeneged Beis Heroyon, we beat her, we hit her opposite the part of her body, her belly, in which the child is being carried. Kedei Shiyomu Savlad Tchila, in order to ensure that the child, the unborn, dies first, kidei shelo tovo lidei nivol, so that we avoid a situation of desecration. What do we mean by that? The Gemara goes on to say, lemeimra, this suggests dehi kodma umesa bereisha, that without this beating of her belly, the woman would have died first in this execution. She would have died first, and then only after minutes or maybe even longer, then and only then the child would die. In the meantime, you would notice the belly of a dead woman fluttering with the life of the unborn in it. And that is considered something of a desecratory nature regarding the human being. To have a dead person with a belly movement as a result of an unborn that's inside. So in order to prevent this desecration, we ensure that when the woman is killed, there will be no further movement. And that's accomplished by beating her belly beforehand. So at this point, we're leading into a question. You can see we have a long question marking. We are saying right now that without any intervention, the mother dies first. The Gemara asks, V'ha kaimalon devlad mayis bereisha, but we know that the child dies first, disnan. And from where do we know this idea that that when a mother dies, the child dies first? Disnan, the following source says, Tinok ben yoimo yinoichil umanchil. A tinok that's a day old, he is capable of inheriting from one side and bequeathing to another side. What does that mean? The Omar of Sheshes, Noichel benich sehoim, lahanchil la'achen min ho'av. This is describing a case of a man that had children from two wives, and the child spoken about over here has brothers through a common father. The Rashi, you'll notice at the end of the narrow lines, Elo nochel benichse imoi, imesa boi bayoim, vafilu hu meis bo bayom. If the mother of this child, of this infant, died on the same day, but a little earlier than this infant, So you have the mother dying, call her wife number one of this man. She dies, leaving an infant a day old, and on that same day, the infant itself dies. Nochel nichsi imo, the infant is capable of inheriting from property from its mother. Umanchilon mikoychoi leechov me'oviv. He then, upon his death, serves as a benefactor of his brothers through the common father. She'enon b'nei imo, they are not the children of that mother. So what did we just describe? We just described the situation of an infant inheriting from his mother, and upon its own death, passing the property on to its brothers that it has together with their common father. And we now infer, Dafka ben Yom Echad. Only if the child had been born already could it serve in this capacity as a conduit, if you will, of the property of its mother over to its brothers from their common father. Aval ubar loy. But if the child was unborn, so you have a woman dying carrying an unborn child, this transfer of property to its brothers would not work. Rather, her family would inherit the property that she may have held. Why do we say that the unborn would not have served as this conduit? The unborn, we say, why not? The who mayis beresha. If the mother is dying, we say that the vlad would have died first. Notice we've dashed underlined this expression. Do mayis beresha. Contrast this with what we saw at the beginning of this long question, where we said lemeimra dehi kadma umesa beresha, where we thought that the mother would have died first. That's why we said that we have to hit the belly. Here we're seeing that the child anyway would die first. V'ein haben yoyreshes imoy bekever lahanchil lochin minav. And as far as the rules of inheritance are concerned, we say that a dead person who's dead and buried, so to speak, a dead person cannot inherit from his mother and bequeath unto his brothers from a common father. After all is said and done, what are we seeing? We're seeing that when can an infant serve as a conduit of property, and serve as an heir and a benefactor? It's only if he's born. But if he's unborn, he can't do that. And why is that? Because he actually dies before his benefactor, in this case, his mother. The Gemara says, Hani Mili, this idea that a Vlad dies first, the Gabi Misa, that's when you're dealing with a natural death. The one responsible for natural death is called the Malach HaMoves, the angel of death. And he deposits a drop in the deceased that causes his death. This drop of poison, if you will, we say as follows, Aidi devlad zutru chiyuse, since an unborn, its whole life breath is less than a born living individual. Zutru means small. Its life is small. Its its strength of life is limited in the first place. Ailo tipo de malachamovis umechatech luhu lesimonim. When the angel of death comes to take the life of its mother away, so since its life is itself weak in the first place, it will die before the mother. Avol neherga, but in a case where the deceased is a victim of being of execution, of being killed, actively killed, like is the case in our Mishnah, there we say he mesa beresha. Without any intervention, the mother would die first. Therefore, we hit her belly so as to ensure that the vlad dies, first to avoid the desecration scene that we described above. The Gemara asks for Hoha the Uvda, but there was an incident with a woman that was Mesa, that she died naturally, Upirchis Atlas Pirchusi, and the Vlad continued to flutter. Three movements after the mother died through natural causes. So we see that even in the case of Mesa, the woman dies first. The Gemara says, no, these flutterings do not show any sign of actual life on the part of that Vlad, the unborn. Rather, midi dehave azonav halito'o de mefarcheses. It is no different than the severed tail of a lizard that continues to flutter after it's been severed. No one is going to suggest that the fluttering of a severed tail indicates that the tail has a life of its own. So we can say that in truth, the Vlad really does die first in the case of a natural death, and the subsequent flutterings are not a sign of any life. Before going further in the Gemara, we have a topic heading that we would like to refer to on the outside margin, the Nosei, Din Shel Shmuel, Ho'isha Shiyoshva LaMashber, Umeisa B'Shabbos. This is talking about a woman who's about to give birth. She is Yoshva LaMashber, she starts the birthing process, and it happens to be Shabbos, and in the course of her starting to give birth, the woman dies. So we continue in our introduction reading after we say Umeso B'Shabbos, Mevin Sakin, we bring a knife, the Koran is Kresa, we tear open her belly, Umotzian Esavlad, and we remove the child. The Gemara. Omar of Nachman Omar Shmuel, Ho'isha Shiyoshva LaMashber, Umeso B'Shabbos. According to the Shita Mekubetzis on Omid Beis in Ois Aleph, we're talking about a very specific situation of a woman who's in the process of childbirth and the head of the child actually emerged already. And so as this woman is giving birth, she dies, and it's on Shabbos, Mevin Sakin V'Kurin Es Kresa, we bring a knife and tear open her belly, Umotzian Es Avlad, and remove the child. The Gemara asks, do I really need Shmuel to teach me this point of law? Pshita, my Ovid. Of course you're allowed to do that. What is he doing? What violation could there possibly be? Mechatech beboser, who he's merely cutting meat, meaning the woman's belly, and there is no chiyuv, there is no violation of cutting into flesh, other than the case of the flesh of a living individual. That's called choyvel b'chai, where one causes a blood flow. But here, the woman has died. So what's Shmuel revealing to me? Omar Rabo loy nitzricho lahavi sakin derech rishus harabim. What Shmuel is telling us is that you're allowed, under these circumstances, to carry the knife through a public thoroughfare. In other words, there is a Shabbos violation, not insofar as the cutting of the flesh, but with regard to the carrying of the knife. On Shabbos, as many of you know, there is a prohibition of transferring items from private areas to public areas, as well as carrying things through a public area of a distance of more than 4 amos. So, this is the point, this is the chiddush that's being revealed, that one's allowed to carry the knife through a Rishus HaRabim in order to save this newborn. Newborn meaning we're enabling it to be born as a result of cutting her open. The Gemara asks, Umay Komash Molon, what really is the point being taught here by Shmuel? And notice we're starting a long question, As you can see, the kuf encircled the immediate right-hand side of the Gemara text with the vertical descending dashed line. So what's he really telling us? Demisfeika mechalalinon shavata, that even though we're in a state of doubt, will this child really continue living or not? And yet, we will violate the Shabbos. Well, I don't really need Shmuel for that. Tanina. We know that from another Tanaic source. Mi shenoflo lov mapoilis. Sofek husham, sofek eno sham. A person upon whom there was an avalanche fell, or a building collapsed, and there is a doubt whether there really is an individual there or not. Sofek chai, sofek meis. Even if he's there, there's a doubt whether he is alive, whether he is dead. Sofek kenani, sofek Yisrael. There's a doubt whether he is a kenani, and therefore we would not violate Shabbos on his behalf. Sufik, whether he is a Yisrael, and therefore we would violate Shabbos on his behalf. So we have a situation of absolute doubt. Mefakhin olav esagal. We will remove the avalanche in order to save the individual, even though there's a sufik as to whether I'm really saving a life in the first place. So we see that Shabbos is able to be violated in order to save a life, even if there's an issue of doubt. So, once again, what do I need Shmuel's halacha for? The Gemara answers, Mahu detema. Without Shmuel's halacha, I would have thought still there's a difference. Hussam, in the case of the collapse of material on the victim, Hu dahava le chazoka dechisa. We're talking about a person that we knew was alive. The doubt is whether he is still alive or not. But he had originally, there had been a status of definite life, which is now being brought into question. Aval hacha, the case of Shmuel with the newborn, delo havele chazoka dechiyusim eikora, this is a child that we don't know if it would continue living in the first place. Generally speaking, we say that a child gains a cheskes chayim after it lives for 30 days. It leaves the realm of being a sofek nefel, a sofek miscarriage. But here we're talking about on the day of its birth, we are still violating Shabbos in order to save it. So once again, aval hocha delo havilei chazoka dechiyusam eikara eimalo. I would have thought that since it never had a full life status to begin with, maybe I wouldn't violate Shabbos in order to save it. Komash malon, this is what Shmuel reveals, that even under such circumstances, we will violate Shabbos. Ho'isho shenerga nehenin besaira. At this point, we discuss the issue of the hair that was referred to in the Mishnah. The Mishnah, on a simple translation basis, says that the woman who's executed by the court, one is allowed to benefit from her hair, making a wig or using it as a material for other products. The Gemara asks, "V'amai? Why is it mutter to benefit from her hair? Isurei hanon inhu. It's within the realm of things, items forbidden to benefit from." Rashi quotes the source in which the pasuk says, "Vatomas shom Miriam." And through word comparisons, we come to the conclusion that a dead individual is forbidden to benefit from. So how can you tell me that this executed woman, you can benefit from her hair? Omar Rav, Be'oimeres tenu sa'ari lebiti. We're talking about a case where the condemned said beforehand, give my hair to my daughter. We now encounter triangles, and you'll notice as we skim ahead in the Gemara how these triangles appear alternatively in different directions. Sometimes point up, sometimes point down. In the outside margin, you'll see a triangle featured, next to which we have the expression ma'akav. Ma'akav means an attempt to keep track of a give-and-take style Gemara. with the point facing up, they represent kushyos, questions, and facing down, responses, tshuvos, answers. So Rav told us that the case of the Mishnah involves a woman who says, "Give my hair to my daughter." The Gemara asks, "Ilu omra tnu yodi labiti mi avina la?" And if the condemned would have said, "Give my arm to my daughter," would we do that? Certainly no. So what's the difference? Omar Rav, a response, "Bepeot nochris." You'll notice we have a diamond around Rav, and to the immediate right-hand side of the Gemara text, you see a number 1. In the margin under our Nosei Mivneh heading, the diamond is featured, and we've written, "Shnei deois lahasbir ha dikotoni ha isha shenerga nenin besaira." We have two approaches to explain this halacha concerning the executed woman and the benefit from her hair. One explanation will feature peo nochris. Peo nochris is a term that nowadays is a reference to a wig. As far as Rashi is concerned, peo nochris is something very similar to that. It's outside hair that a woman attaches to her own head of hair, which she feels is rather thin or lacking, so she uses this extra hair that's essentially a wig. Or a braid that she attaches. So it's not her own hair growing from her head that we are talking about. So we now continue with this discussion, bearing in mind that we're talking about a peah nochris. We'll use the term wig as we go along in the Gemara. So what is the reason that we're allowed to benefit from her hair, the wig? Taimo di omra tenu. This is because she said, "Give the wig to my daughter." Ha loy omra tenu. Had she not said tenu, gufahu, then we're going to view the wig as part of her body, like her arm, umitzar, and it would become forbidden. Forbidden as a result of her being executed. The Gemara asks, "V'ha mibaya lei the Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Chanina?" But this issue isn't so open and shut. It's not so clear. Rabbi Yosi Rabbi Chanina himself asked the boy Rabbi Yosi Chanina. He asked a question concerning the topic of ir hanidachas. Maybe a word or two about that before we go on. Ir hanidachas is a city in which the population practiced idolatry. As a result of that, the city is condemned to death. And not only that, but the property of its inhabitants are destroyed. You may have a situation that in an ir hanidachas there are actual innocent people, people that didn't follow along in the practice of idolatry. Well, those people are definitely spared execution. However, their property must be destroyed along with the rest of the city. That point should be borne in mind as we go along in the Gemara. Rabbi Yosi Bar Chanina asked, "Seor noshim tzidkonios mahu?" The hair of the righteous women in the ir hanidachas, what is the fate of the hair? The Omar Rava bepeo nochris komebayale. Rabbi Yosi Bar Chanina is asking about the wigs. So you can see that it's not so clear as to how we classify the wig. Do we classify it as her body or not? In other words, if it were clear that it were gufa, that it were part of her body, then since she's a tzadekis in the ir hanidachas, she, along with her wig, would be spared. Since he's asking about the wig, it's not so clear that it's considered gufa. According to Rav, the wig on its own, in other words, the wig without any formal instructions, the wig is considered gufa. It seems to be obvious, according to this piece of Gemara it appears that it's not so obvious. The Gemara answers, Ki komabil Rabbi Yossi b'chanina. When Rabbi Yossi b'chanina raised his question, he raised his question concerning the toli b'sichsa. The wig was on a hook. It wasn't worn by the Isha Tzadekis. If it were worn by the Isha Tzadekis, by the righteous woman, it would be obvious in the case of the Irei Anidachas that it would be spared along with the woman that's wearing it. So now, Hacha, in our Mishnah, where we're talking about the woman that was executed, the Mechaber Ba, it's a worn wig. She's wearing it. And the only reason it can be mutter is Taima di Amra Tenu. As Rav said at the beginning of this Gemara, she instructed, I want it to be given to my daughter. Ha lo Amra Tenu, had she not issued this instruction, Gufa hu umitsar, it would be considered as part of her and rendered forbidden along with her death. The Gemara asks, Kashya lei l'Rav Nachman bar Yitzchok. Rav Nachman asks, how can you set up the Mishnah dealing with a wig? V'hodumyo d'behema katoni. The case of the woman and her hair is taught along with the case of an animal that's executed. Ma hosam gufei. Just like by the case of the animal's hair is not something that's from the outside. Apochinami, so too with regard to the woman, gufei. It's talking about hair growing from her head and not a peonochris, and not a wig. Ela Omer of Nachman. Notice, we have a new diamond, another diamond. This is a second approach. And the second approach says that we're talking about her hair mamish, and nevertheless, there is room for making a distinction between a woman who's executed and an animal that's executed. Zu misosa osarta. In the case of the woman, it's her death, it's death that creates prohibition. And we have to further explain that hair is not something that experiences death. It's viewed differently than her flesh and bones, her body, as opposed to her hair. Hair doesn't experience death, so that the mechanism that creates prohibition doesn't affect hair. Vizu, the case of the behema, gemar dina osarta, it's the verdict of guilt that creates the prohibition. So when the guilt verdict is issued, it affects the entire entity, the entire animal. Hence, all of it becomes forbidden. Toni Levi Kavose de Rav. Toni Levi Kavose de Rav Nachman Yitzchok. Levi presents Tanaic sources, one paralleling Rav, and the other paralleling Rav Nachman bar Yitzchok. Rashi says on the lower part of the Rashi commentary, lower part of the narrow lines, Toni Levi Kavose de Rav, the Moikim law that set up the Mishnah that said Saira Mutter b'de Omra Tnu u'bepeya nochris. That was Rav's approach, and we have a source that reflects that. Let's now turn to the continuation of the Gemara. Toni Levi Kavose de Rav. Levi teaches a Tanaic source like Rav's explanation that we're dealing in the Mishnah with a wig, and the heter is only because she said, give it to my daughter. The source says, Ho'isha she'yotze lahareg, a woman who's being taken out to be executed by the court, v'omra tnu sairi labiti, nosen, and she says, I want you to give my hair to my daughter, so we give it. Mesa, if she dies without having said tenu, ein noisnin, so we don't give it. Neshames oser b'hano, and it's forbidden because the dead individual is forbidden to benefit from. So the Gemara asks pshita, That's obvious. Elo shenoye hames osur bahano. The noye hames means things that adorn the mace, like the peyonochers, like the wig. So we have this source that features the prohibition of a wig because of this absence of her instructions, of the victim's instructions to give it to the daughter. That approach is the approach Rav took in our Mishnah. Tanyo kavose de Rav Nachman ben Yitzchok. And now a support to his approach. Ho'isha shemesa nenin besaira. A woman who dies, one is able to benefit from her hair. Behemo shenergo asuro bano. An animal that was executed because of its capital offense, one cannot benefit from it whatsoever, even from its hair. Uma hefresh bein zeh lo zeh. What's the difference between the woman who was executed and the animal? Answer, zu misosa osarta, vizu gemardina osarta. In the case of the woman, it's her death that creates prohibition of benefiting from her, and hair is not a bar misa, hence the hair is not affected by that element or that event that causes prohibition. And the behem, on the other hand, it's final verdict, the legal verdict that's rendered is what creates the prohibition. That represents the end of the first perek of Erechin, and now we continue with the second perek, but before we do that, we turn to the introduction that we have under our nosei heading in the outside margin. We have written the following, Ein be'erechin pochos misela. An erechin donation cannot be less than a sela, that's a type of coin, b'mikre shel oni shenidon behesigyan. And here we're dealing with a person who's impoverished, who lacks the ability to pay for his erechin donations, and therefore he goes through a type of evaluation: how much can he afford, and the minimum amount that he can get away with, so to speak, or is a sela. The lo yoser mechamishim sela, and erechin dedications never exceed 50 sela. Sela being a type of coin. So the Mishnah, Ein be'erechin pochos misela v'lo yeser achamishim sela. In the realm of erechin, there isn't any less than a sela and no more than 50 sela. Ketzad. Now the Mishnah illustrates how this point has legal ramifications. A person who, let us say, was impoverished. Rashi uses as an example here someone who was 20 years old. A 20-year-old person, if he is an age, a 20-year-old male, the Torah says, has an erech value, a Torah erech value of 50 sela. So you have, let us say, a person who's 20 years old, whose Torah value is listed as 50 sela, but he happens to be very poor. Nosan sela v'heshir, if he paid a sela, and then, after paying it, he became wealthy, eino nosen klum. He doesn't have any further obligation. He doesn't have to pay any more. Because when he paid the sela, that's all he could be asked to pay. Truth be told, even if he can't afford a sela, that much he must pay. But if he pays the sela as an oni, as an impoverished individual, the fact that later on he comes into the money has no bearing. However, this same individual, this 20-year-old, who had obligated himself to give his Torah value, but he gave less than a sela, pochos misela, the hashir, and then he becomes rich, noisein chamishim sela, he then is obligated to pay the balance, to pay 50 sela, which shows us that the first payment of pochos misela, with that he didn't fulfill anything. Hoyu biyodov chomesh sloyim, a poor man, a 20-year-old that has 5 sela in his possession. Rabbi Meir Omer, eino nosein elo achas. All he has to pay is 1 sela, even though he possesses 5. All he has to pay is 1 sela. V'chachomim oimrim noisein es kulon. He pays whatever he has. If he has five, he gives five. Ein ne'rochen pochos misela, v'lo yeser al-chamishim sela. This closing phrase needs some explanation. It seems to be fairly obvious, and we'll have to wait for the Gemara to deal with it. The Gemara. We have a little aleph put in here because this section of the Gemara deals with the minimum amount, and a few lines later we have a beis written in where we deal with the maximum amount. The Gemara. Ein erochen pochos misela. We said that there is no erech that's less than a sela minolon. From where do we know that? Now, the point of this question is that when you look at the Torah and it describes genders and ages, in fact, you don't find anything less than three sela. So the question here is, where do you come up, where does the Mishnah come up with this idea of one sela? The Gemara answers, "Dichtiv v'chol erkecho yeh b'shekel ha-kodesh." From this pasuk we derive, "Kol erech in shato marich," any erech, donation, or dedication that one makes, "lo yu p'husin mishekel." The pasuk mentioned shekel ha-kodesh. So we learn from here it cannot be any less than a shekel. And as we mentioned earlier, this is talking about a person who is truly impoverished. So we'll ask of him, or insist upon him, of paying one shekel. V'lo yeser al chamishim sloyim, and no more than three sloyim, nor more than 50 sloyim. The maximum erech is 50 sloyim. Dichtiv chamishim, because the Torah itself records that amount, and nothing more. Hoyu biyodov chamisha. Now, in this part of the Mishnah, we saw a controversy between Rabbi Meir and the Chachomim. Someone who's impoverished, who is holding five sela. Rabbi Meir said he gives only one. On the outside margin of our Noseh heading, we offer the following. Hezber Machloikis, the point of this Gemara will be to explain the Machloikis between Rabbi Meir and the Chachomim, the Inyan Oni ben Esrim, Shehoya biyodoi Chomesh Slayim, that this 20-year-old male Oni that was holding five sela, the Omer Erki Olai, and he said, I want to donate my Torah value. Kamot Tzorch Losis, how much does he have to give? So our Gemara continues, my time under Rabbi Meir, what's the basis, the reasoning of Rabbi Meir that says you give only one, even though he has four more sela in his possession? Answer, Ksiv Chamishim Uksiv Shekel. The Torah makes reference to 50, and the Torah makes reference to 1. From this we learn, Oy Chamishim, Oy Shekel. It's either or. It's almost like saying all or nothing, but the nothing in this case is one Sela. Nothing, no reference to some in-between payment. V'Rabbonon, the Rabbonon, they say hahu, the word shekel that appears in the pasuk is to tell me l'chol erchin shatomarich lo yu p'chusim meshekel hu da'asa. All it's coming to tell me is if one makes an erech donation and he has no money whatsoever, he has to give one shekel, not less than a shekel. He needs to fulfill his words, his erech vow by giving a shekel. Avol hecho de is lay, if he has more, omar kro. There's another pasuk that says asher tasig yad hanoder, whatever the vower can afford. Vahare yodo maseges. In this case, he has four more. He's got five selas. So his yodo maseges. He's able to afford that because by mere fact that he has that in his possession. V'Rebbe Meir, well, what about Rebbe Meir? Does it not say Asher Tasid Yad HaNoder? He says, Hahu Yad HaNoder V'lo Yad HaNidar Hu Da'asa. This is a teaching that says that a poor man that gave the erech of a rich man, we go according to the person making the vow and not the subject of the vow. v'rabbanan, who say you give five, lav memelo shames mina, do we not derive anyway the hecha de yodoy maseges shkol minei, that where he can afford, take from what he can afford? Glancing at the Rashi on this line, lav memelo shamino mina, afagav dekro lahochi osa. Even though, granted, the pasuk is telling me velo yad hanidar, this pasuk of Asher tasig yad hanoder does teach me what Rabbi Meir said, that we go according to the vower and not according to the subject. Miu al pi Asher tasig siv. The pasuk nevertheless makes reference to what you can afford. Umemelon shamis, and we derive anyway from that that where he has, where his he has attained something, money, take it from him. As we go on in the Gemara, we have a new marking. You see a double underline, and in the outside margin, we have a nose mivne heading, where the double underline is featured. Divrei Rav Ado Bar Ahava, we're going to be emphasizing his name. Be'inyan mi sheyesh biyado chamisha sloyim, referring to someone that has five sela, u'mekabel al atzmo erkoi yoiser mipam achas, and he mentions his desire of giving his erech more than once. Once again, we're featuring a person who is impoverished. He's not doesn't have a lot of money, and yet he says, "I want to give my erech." Omar v'ado barava hoyu biyodav chomesh sloyim v'omar erki olai v'chozer v'omar erki olai. Now, the marking that you see this volcano form, you can see in the under our nosei mivne heading, the volcano shape is featured. Mikrim shel ha'oima erki olai v'chozer v'omar erki olai, different cases that fall under this same event where he repeats himself by saying erki olai twice. V'hoya biyodo chamesh sloyim u'pitzel es nesinosam, and he splits his giving of the five dalit sloyim v'sela echad into four and one. So we have a person that made a reference to two erki donations. He has a total of five sloyim, and he splits his giving of the money. What legal ramifications does that bear? So we continue in the Gemara. V'nosan arba l'shnia v'echa l'rishoina. He gives four of the five sloyim toward the second erech donation, and one, the remaining sela, he gives toward the first statement. Yotza yedei shtehem. With that, he has fulfilled both vows, and he doesn't have to give any more. And we say he fulfills both vows, even according to the Rabbonan. My taima, how is it that he fulfills both vows? Answer: Balchov meuchor shekidim v'gova. We have an example here of a later creditor. It's a balchov meuchor. In this case, the second erech came after he already vowed to pay an erech. And yet, the second vow was paid off first, because it said, we saw here, Nosan Arba Lishni, paid four of the five sela toward the second vow. That's an example of a balchov meuchor, a later creditor, jumping the gun and collecting ahead of time, if you will, earlier. Generally speaking, the earlier creditor has earlier claims. However, if a later creditor comes and jumps the gun and collects beforehand, we say, ma shegova gova, whatever he's lucky to get, he gets. Be'idno diyoyev lishnia, when the second vow was being paid in this case, mishabed l'rishona, all of the money really was indebted toward the first vow. In other words, the four that he paid toward the second vow were basically indebted toward the first erki vow. Be'idna diyoyiv l'rishona, in this case where he actually came to pay off the first one, su lesle, he doesn't have any more money. So he's paying off the first vow with the last bit that he had in his possession. Let's glance at the Rashi at the bottom. Ma shegova gova, the hilkoch kiyoiv l'rishona, when he eventually pays the remaining one sela toward the first vow, kol madis leyoivle, he's given him everything that he has. Uleshnia leko lemeimar, and regarding the second vow, there isn't any room to say amai lo yoiv kulhu chomesh. Hey, why didn't you use all five to pay the second vow? Mishum debeidna dioivle shnia, when he was paying the second toward the second vow, mishtabid lo the rishona, the money was indebted toward the first one. Even that which he paid toward the second vow really wasn't owed to the second vow per se. At the top of Daf Ches Amid Aleph, we see another example of this event, where the Gemara says, Nosan arbo l'rishona v'achas l'shneo, he paid four of the five toward the first debt, first vow, and the one remaining sela toward the second. Yedei shnia yotza, yedei rishona lo yotza. We say that as far as the second erech is concerned, he has fulfilled that. There's no further debt. However, with regard to the first one, he has not fulfilled his obligation, and we're going according to the Rabbonon. Kulu mishabdon l'rishona, all five were bound to the first. So he didn't pay toward the first what he should have paid, leaving open a balance, a debt. And therefore, the payment of the, in this case, of the four toward the first was insufficient. With that, we conclude our shiur for today.